Hello.
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 Yes, is this the wellness training?
I'm assuming so.
Yes. We're hoping so.
Oh, okay.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave Kruger. I'm really excited about doing this seminar series with you about the art and science of coaching wellness. First, thanks to each of you who have already sent back responses to the two questions of what's the most important thing you'd like to focus on and what would you like to walk away with. I have not had a time because I've been back-to-back to review them, but I promise I will, and I'll incorporate your requests and reflections into the discussion of what will unfold. Now, first, the link that you had and have most recently from me is the link where each of the four recordings will be posted within a day of the recording, usually by the next morning. Also notice that there's an outline. It's a fairly annotated outline, so you don't have to take a bunch of notes and have a way of listening then instead of writing, and a workbook. And you'll see that with the workbook, if you really want to do and can do the exercises and work tools prior to the seminar that will be an elaboration of that, or that that'll be a reference for, all the better. So if we can, and I appreciate you guys managing the background noise, I'll go on lecture mode in just a bit so you don't have to worry about this, but first I wanted to have a discussion at the beginning and the end of each of our seminars to see what you're, and again, I need a management of background noise. You won't hear what we hear if there's movement or anything like that. So if you would remain on mute, star six, until you get ready to make a comment or ask a question, and then unmute star six when you're ready to do that. So anyone want to add to or respond to the question of, if we were to sit down right now, socially, safely, distance, of course, and masked, and you were to say, what's the most important thing you'd like to get out of this seminar series? And the question, 4 weeks from now, if you walk away saying this is one of the best series I've ever attended, what would you walk away with? Anybody want to answer one or both of those just very briefly? But one at a time now. Anybody want to take a shot at any of that about what really you hope to? You had some hopes, some ideas about what you want to get out of this in terms of coaching wellness. Or is there something specifically that you really want to walk away with, for example?
David?
Hi, Dave. This is
Amelia. Oh, go ahead, Amelia. Thank you. Go
ahead. I actually have really enjoyed my coach training up to this point, and I'm hoping that I will just get some new perspective and motivation for coaching my clients, because I realize that I don't know what I don't know, and I'm looking forward to learning more. So
okay.
I'm pretty wide open.
That's great. To know to ask is half the answer. So super. Thank you, Amelia. Someone else spoke at the same time. Would you go now?
Thank you.
Hi, David.
My name is...
This is Trish. How are you?
Hi, Trey, and I want to go back to the guy who spoke who I didn't hear, but go ahead.
Who are you talking to? I'm sorry.
You. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm actually trained as holistic health counselor, but I haven't been coaching in so long, and this I really want to go and have a refresher course and get clear on who my clients are going to be. And also create healthy habits for myself as well.
Okay. All right. The best way we can help our clients is to be very clear about our own story and know exactly how to create a system. Because if you want to make a change, if you want to change a habit or create a new habit, focus on the system. Because everybody has the same goal. So we're going to be talking about micro and macro systems and understanding that, including incorporating the mind and brain sciences with strategic coaching. So you definitely came to the right place. To the guy who I heard, would you go now, please? And
thank
you for your patience.
Absolutely. My name is Salim. I came across this class a couple of months ago. I just finished my coaching certification with CTA, and I am a certified career transition coach. I do a lot of strategic planning coaching for different nonprofit organizations. And 30 years ago, I got introduced to an idea at the American Management Association of evaluating staff members and employees, and
may I nudge you to focus on what you'd like us to do and like to get out of this collaboration together? And I'm sorry to interrupt, but I have to be aware of the time, and I hope you don't mind.
No, I of course.
So your
I
focus would
that.
Be what?
My focus would be focusing on the individual as a whole.
Okay.
Personally, professionally, the individual as a whole, and that I thought would address that.
Okay. All right. Great. Thank you for that input. I appreciate it. Anyone
sure.
else?
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm great. Who is this?
This is Jaden.
Welcome. Hey,
and,
go ahead.
Thank you. So I recently just became a life purpose coach, and I've been an avid meditator for a couple of years now. Love everything wellness. I know what works for me, but I am hoping to get some more, I guess, generalized or other directions of tools that can work for other people as well, because everybody's different, so just kind of ways to navigate the individual a little more.
Okay, I think that's a really good question, because as we work as mentor coaches, it's about our client. And that's why we ask powerful questions, to focus on them, not making it about us or giving them our solutions or trying to fix it, which moves the point of reference to us, but really developing that from the client's perspective, developing the optimum story, and in this case, the wellness story of the client, in the very best way possible. So us being a catalyst for that is exactly what we'll talk about, and ways to go about that and think about developing that with individual clients. So I appreciate that input. Anybody else want to add anything to the hopper before we move into a mode of lecture mode instead of discussion mode? Who else? Well, I'll move us then into the lecture mode so you don't have to worry about background noise, and I'll reserve some time at the end for discussion. So if there's any clarification or question that you have, jot it down, and we'll have a brief discussion at the end. So, again, welcome to the Art and Science of Coaching Wellness. In our first session, I want to talk with you about the power of story and the concept of writing a new wellness story. Now, this is going to parallel the introduction and preface in the workbook that you've hopefully downloaded and see. In the following three sessions, we're going to develop and apply a philosophy and a model of coaching wellness that can be used with individuals and groups anywhere in the world. Now, throughout, I'm going to speak to you about your wellness story. I encourage you to do the exercises and work pages in the workbook to parallel our discussion. Then you'll know firsthand how to develop a wellness story, and then we'll apply how to coach one. Now, although we'll discuss application to wellness, you're going to see that the principles are fundamental to all growth, change, and success. Why you? You may have asked. Or why me? You're professionals who know how to listen and guide people. You're change experts and choice architects. You know that intentions need a strategy and a plan. You know that focusing on goals are not enough. What really brings about change is focusing on the system so that your client will know what they need to do next when they hang up the phone from you. You'll learn a proven system of transformation for lasting change. The roadmap system, the acronym for the 7 steps to understand the algorithms of how we construct a story, here applied to wellness, will be a master plan to guide you to empowered wellness in your story, including the tools and exercises that you can then coach. So what's the need for wellness coaching? You've seen what I believe are some compelling statistics, perhaps already in the workbook preface. Here's my belief. People don't need more advice about vitamins or told again to exercise or lose weight or stop smoking. If information were enough, we'd all be thin, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd have a lot of money saved up for the future, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. But information has never sold a single widget. It's never helped someone lose a single pound or get a bit healthier. Now, here's an example of what information from an expert, when someone consults an expert, will do. If you go to a physician and you're consulting that expert about something you're concerned about, that expert gives you a recommendation. Let's say it's in the form of a prescription. Guess how many people actually follow the advice of that expert? Less than 50% actually fill the prescription. Of those who fill it, less than 50% take it as prescribed. So even when somebody's motivated by pain, scared, and do all that they have to do, even figure out how to work Zoom these days, to go to a physician, less than 1 in 4 actually follow that expert advice. What's missing? They need to make wellness their story, to own it, for it not to be the physician's or someone else's story. People need a clear, specific, stepwise process, a system for change, and an informed guide to help them. They need an accountability partner who's expert at change. The mission of wellness coaching is to help people establish healthier lifestyles, to write their wellness stories. In addition to individuals interested in health and longevity, who else needs wellness coaching? One answer can be any business interested in achieving these goals: reducing medical claims, lowering stress, reducing absenteeism, improving morale, improving retention rates, to generate overall savings in the organization. So, let's look first at what's the scope of wellness coaching. So, in addition to individual and group coaching, here are some examples of the portals of entry, the gatekeepers, who you also can refer to as referral sources for wellness coaching: human resource heads and groups, employee assistance programs, healthcare insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, small business owners, school systems, government agencies, especially organizations that are self-insured. Natural affiliates include fitness trainers, clubs, nutritionists, holistic healthcare providers, healthcare providers of any nature or specialty, consortiums of wellness practitioners. So let's move to the application now. Why is it that change is so difficult? In studies of coronary bypass patients admitted to an acute ICU, when their lives are at risk and they're told that unless they change their nutrition, their lifestyle, they have little chance of survival, how many then go on after this near-death experience and education about what they need, an introduction to the resources? 1 in 9. It took Semmelweis more than 20 years to persuade doctors that washing their hands could save the lives of mothers giving birth. He had the data, the proof, but that wasn't enough to change minds. He died before people believed in change. Changing behavior is difficult. We're going to talk a little bit more about that, because that's something that's a challenge in every aspect of coaching. What keeps people from doing what they need to do for themselves? What makes it difficult to change even when someone's life depends on it? For example, data shows that driving while texting is more dangerous than driving while drunk. But how many people does that stop? Some of the resistance is staying in a comfort zone of the predictable and the familiar. Another component of resistance is our brains naturally resist change because they're programmed to operate on the default mode of repetition. Keep this question in your margin notes. Why is change so difficult? We're going to return to that and strategize around it, because how you deal with that collaboratively with a client is going to generate the successful coaching resolution. You have to own your wellness story. The light on the dashboard appears that says service engine now. You disconnect it so it doesn't shine. It's like, yeah, you've dealt with it, but not really. Another term, denial. But once you know something, you can never not know it again. Denial is still a form of engagement, even though it's invisible consciously, above ground. People are afraid to go to the doctor. They aren't afraid of doctors. They're afraid their denial will be confronted. Making a physical symptom go away does the same thing. The symptom is the signal, a story in itself, a story needing, even begging, to be listened to and understood. Your body will simply find another way to bring you more information. And just because you're not sick doesn't mean you're healthy. Wellness is a mindset. This mindset gives ownership of a life story of wellness to each individual. And with this ownership comes the responsibility and privilege that each thought, feeling, experience, and behavior is created each moment. It's not there until you create it. Warren Buffett used the analogy of buying a car. If you get a new car every few years, the approach would be different then if you knew you were going to choose one car and have it for the rest of your life, you'd probably do research to know the best care for that car, maybe change the oil more frequently, do everything possible for maintenance. Knowing it was the only car for the rest of your life, you'd take meticulous care of it. Your body is the only one you'll have for the rest of your life. It's irreplaceable. Everything about its care and maintenance matters. It reflects the cumulative care you take of it. Everything accounts. And everything counts. Later, when you have time, look at the addendum. I think it's on page 6 of the addendum, to see how two little French fries can weigh 40 pounds. Now, wellness integrates mind, body, and spirit with a balanced flow of energy. If you haven't already, I'd recommend you read the Wellness System of Energy in the preface of the workbook. It begins on page little Roman numeral 12. It introduces some later discussions on the impact of change on mind and body. And now, this is from the teachings of the Tao. The source of spiritual energy is physical, rooted in the base chemistry of the body. Self-cultivation refines this energy for spiritual attainment. Enlightenment is a psychophysiological achievement, a state of being rather than intellectual understanding. Spirituality is an expression of energy. So there's no dichotomy of mind, body, and spirit. So let's look at now developing a new wellness story. We're in a revolution in the science and neuroscience of wellness and of aging. We understand how our bodies work at the cellular level. We understand healthy aging. We can live healthier lives than anyone in all of biological time. This has taken quite a while because health is biologically way more complex than disease. Of 3,000 people surveyed, three activities stood out above all others that prompted procrastination. Things that people know what to do, know what they need to do, but don't do it. Working out, a better diet, and saving money. More than anything else, people put off these three things. And these three areas of life, exercise, nutrition, saving money, are things that people know exactly what to do, yet they don't do it. It is not lack of information. You will not change anyone's mind by giving more information. In fact, since we have a belief system, we have all kinds of beliefs. Some are conscious, some are not. We'll seek data. When we hear new information, we'll seek data to validate what information already fits that belief system, and if it doesn't fit, we'll find ways to invalidate it. In fact, the smarter people are, the more developed their ways of refuting it. It's called the boomerang effect. So, what if you treated a task like exercise with the same mindset as work, or coach your client to do this? With work, you don't have to get up every day and debate about whether you will or won't, whether you're going to take a few days off or just skip it. Work is there. You get up, you go to work. You don't debate about it. You don't consider yourself virtuous if you decide to go to work. It's an organizing force. It's a deeply etched default mode, a part of your identity. You go to work every day, whatever constitutes work, including full-time parenting. Now, I grew up on a farm and ranch. Every morning before school, I fed the cattle. Same every evening. It was a given. No questions asked. Age 8 on. Morning, evening, 7 days a week. Cattle had to eat. My dad helped me make it my story. It stopped being work when some of them were my cattle. I came to appreciate this in college when I heard people grinching at 8 o'clock classes because I didn't use the energy to do that because it was something you did, like the cattle. Now, exercise can be the same mindset, the default story, but it needs a plan and a commitment, just like your business. It needs to be a system. That's why people need coaches. Biologically, your body knows only two things, growth or decay. Dr. Henry Lodge Jr., in his book, Younger Next Year, says that 70% of aging is not aging, but decay. Blood vessels go to every millimeter of your body, and each bathes cells in repair or inflammation. Exercise heals wounded blood vessels. Here's a quote from Henry Lodge in Younger Next Year. Steady exercise is a coded message to your body and your mind. In 20 years, failure to exercise 6 days a week will seem as self-destructive as smoking 2 packs of cigarettes a day. We're going to look at the process of change in an informed, systematic way. And this is also emphasized by Dr. Christian Werner in Hamburg at his institute's findings. Exercise at the molecular level has anti-aging effects. First, I want to provide some context and stimulus for you to actively work on the exercises and quizzes in the workbook for each of the 7 steps. The composite will provide a template, a roadmap, the acronym of the 7 steps to guide and apply your wellness story. It's simply a way that we can use as coaches to understand the components of how someone constructs a story, the algorithms that we operate on, because over 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. But when we understand the principles, we can deconstruct it and look at constructing a revised or even a new one. So let's look first at the power of story. Write this question down. What is my story? Think about your story. It makes you who you are. Summarize your plot in 1 sentence. Bullet your major storylines, not your bio, your title, your role, your plot. And then write this question. What is my wellness story? Consider making an appointment with yourself to brainstorm these 2 questions. Here are some premises that our work together will be based on. 1, plot is the structure, purpose, and pattern of a story. And this is, again, for you as mentor coaches. This is not a way you're going to be talking to your client. This is the way I'm talking to you so that you can have a superordinate way to look at and inform how you respond to your client. For a life story, a plot is the outline of life narratives. The core assumptions of life stories inform what people look for and how they attribute meaning to what they experience. 2, and this is all in your outline, we learn through stories. Stories are how we understand and how we remember. James Watson, the guy who discovered DNA with Crick, said, you know, I can remember something if I can fit it into a story. A story is a system for holding together facts. A story makes things make sense. Defense lawyers know this. Little kids standing next to broken vases know this. Muriel Rukeyser said, the world is made up of stories, not atoms. We personify the economy or the stock market as if it were a story of its own. We make a story out of events in order to infer a relationship, even to assign causality, or to ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creations. My ulcer acted up. My weight gets in the way. Here's a really simple illustration of this. 2 large groups of people were given 8 things to remember. 1 group, they had no context. The other group had the preface to this, the framework of, these are 8 things that have to do with laundry. The people who had a way to organize this did over 40% better on a test of remembering these 8 items. You had something to fit it into. There was a kind of a story. 3, we each have a personal story with a plot and storylines. Our beliefs and assumptions ghostwrite that story. From an infinite sea of possibilities, our software determines what we perceive and then how we process it. The brain needs a story. It's going to infer one anyhow, so it's helpful to know the lexicon. Our plot consists of our core beliefs and assumptions that transform all available information into a system that makes sense. And here's what we know from neuroscience now. We don't believe what we see. We see what we believe. We will pre-select things that fit with our already existing belief systems. We then create life narratives according to plot, since mind and brain are both programmed to process by the default mode and to ignore facts that contradict our assumptions, conscious or not. 4. A life story contains silent assumptions and emotional scripts. We have to believe in order to see again. Some of our beliefs and patterns may be even invisible to ourselves. Here's an example. Gregory Maguire, a best-selling novelist and playwright, for example, the Broadway hit that you probably heard of, Wicked, said, "You know, I didn't realize this at first, but there's almost no central character in any of my 24 books who doesn't have a dead mother or a lost parent. Maguire's mother died from complications during his birth. It was after his 23rd book that he became conscious of this connection to say, you know, I just realized that. And I also recognize I can't seem to start a novel unless the character doesn't have a mother. If the mother's still alive, what's the problem? There's nothing to write about." 5. We believe and remember only that which fits our plot. What we expect to happen in the present reveals instantly our experience in the past. Psychoanalysts call this transference. Someone, let's say, abandoned early in life will expect more of the same in future relationships, even though circumstances change. All subsequent information is absorbed, filtered, and organized by that narrative plot. This is part of what we do in revising or transforming that in mentor coaching. 6. We don't see things as they are. We see things as we are. We see what we believe, and we're always right because we write the story. Here's a simple example. Some of you have heard me tell this story before. This is out of Oxford a number of years ago. Two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They had remarkable similarities of personality, philosophy, and education. This is how they were chosen. When the two anthropologists emerged a year later to compare notes and expected essential similarities, they instead found remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes, integrated into the colony, achieved a comfort and a unity, and got remarkable data. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony. He remained careful and vigilant, always seemed like really right on the cusp of a conflict, and never achieved that harmony. Well, the anthropologist couldn't understand the different results, and they couldn't find any reason because everything looked so similar. They and their teams puzzled for months until they finally discovered one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful outsider, carried a gun. His gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it, but he knew he had it. He knew if things got tough, he had an out. That was his belief. The anthropologist who had no gun believed in a commitment. He knew from the beginning he would either make it or not on his own. And in reconstruction and retrospect, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced. We tell our story, and then our story tells us. 7. A story can define possibilities. And you guys know this story. In centuries of recorded time, no one ran the mile in under 4 minutes. It was physiologically impossible. The belief was, if you did this, you'd die. Dr. Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile in 1954. Within the following 12 months, over a dozen other runners broke the 4-minute mile as well. And in one race, 1 year after Bannister, 3 people in the same race broke the 1-minute mile. The obstacle of the impossible could no longer be constructed. When the mindset of what's possible changes, reality then changes as well. And there's an anecdote I've heard about more recently from someone who knew this situation. When Bannister finished the race, he actually collapsed and kind of passed out on the track. And when he woke up, he said, "Am I dead? I mean, he had that belief that he was still operating on. 8, a story can define reality. A placebo generates the effect of the accompanying story. A patient is prescribed an inert pill and some expectation, a story. In a majority of cases, the story is what becomes a reality. By anticipating an experience, we create it. In fact, the story generates a truth so powerful it can even reverse the pharmacological effect of the real medicine. A placebo is a white lie. It's a fiction that becomes a truth. In fact, a recent MIT study showed that a more expensive placebo works significantly better than a much cheaper one. Same placebo, different stories. And this isn't about being gullible or suggestible. For example, when a patient believes something will reduce pain, the body releases natural endorphins. Medical research suggests that up to 70% even of successful non-surgical treatments are the result of the patient's belief that the treatment will work. And of course, that has to follow the physician's belief that the treatment will work. 9, a story can take over the author. Listen to these expressions. My anger took over. My fear stopped me. A feeling that someone creates is perceived to act on its creator. So here are some ways that we can see ourselves as the victims of the story that we create rather than the author. And each of these, in my view, is a coachable moment. That's why I ask for permission from every client. May I interrupt you if there's something I think would be valuable for both of us to look at this moment? My doubt paralyzed me. My work eroded my free time. My weight gets in the way. We ascribe a story with a mind of its own to our own creation. Here's a brief example of the power of story of a woman I knew who recalled an incident from her adolescence. She attended a Catholic all-girls boarding school. She said, "At one party, I started the rumor that the punch was spiked. Everybody got drunk." 10, your life is the self-statement, the manifestation of what exists inside you. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say and do is about yourself. Everyone is always making self-statements, so don't take it personally. Look in the glossary of the workbook. It's kind of an excuse to define terms so that I can put some of my favorite quotes. But there's an entry on self-statement that might be interesting to look at a later point. You define yourself. Other people's definitions of you are more about themselves, what they project or attribute to make themselves feel better, or what they want or don't want to own, or what they disavow or project. 11, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. Neuroscience shows that pure facts are a myth. Quantum physics seconds the motion. This observation came originally from quantum physics and the process of observing quarks. 12, an authentic belief in someone, and this is immensely important. This is the most important of the 12. Listen carefully to this. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends usual thinking and performance. Now, this comes from neuroscience, even though good parents have known it for centuries. And this works just as well by telephone and in any way remotely as it does face-to-face, sometimes even better because there's not the distraction of all the visual. An authentic belief in someone activates their brain. The most contagious thing in the world, even more than COVID, is a state of mind. Activates their brain to create a state of mind that transcends their usual thinking and performance. This, I believe, is why it's important as a mentor coach to work with people in whom you believe, because it's going to make a difference and they're both going to teach you why. Now, let's return to the question about the difficulty of change. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why do they repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder and expect a different result, even if it leads to lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or disappointing relationships? In The Black Swan, Nassim Taleb writes, "What are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual." So here's a two-part answer. Part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. Even though it's limiting or maybe uncomfortable, it's kind of misnamed to be a comfort zone. It's just a zone of familiarity. It's a default mode, a model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out. That creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation, even anxiety. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort, to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that's synonymous with identity. So this is why the last step in the roadmap, Program NUA, is about identity. So we tend to return to our default mode. Let's do just a brief exercise. If you can, free both hands. Put your palms together, interlock your fingers very tightly. Now, notice which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers still interlocked firmly, but change so that the other thumb is on top. How's that feel? Kind of awkward? Now, move your thumb back to the original position. That's why people don't change. They return to the comfort zone. There's nothing better about your thumb on top the first time around, but it's familiar, and it registers as this is the way things ought to be. Now, up the ante, add significant success or significant stress, such as a major transition, a significant success or setback, really out of a comfort zone. We're going to return later to comfort zones and how to program change, because there's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Always. Every client, every step they make, this is going to be part of their experience. So it's important that we recognize that and know how to facilitate that. So a comfort zone is simply a familiar pattern of behavior. Think about your home thermostat. If the temperature increases or decreases just a degree or two, it signals an adjustment to return to the set point, the comfort zone. Our minds and our brains both contribute to this. We have a comfort zone with our weight. We return to the familiar even if we don't like it, even if it's uncomfortable. Think about how subtle a comfort zone can be in determining choices, what you eat, the difficulty of starting a new exercise program. A habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. So here's the other part of that answer to why change is difficult. It comes from our brains. The hypnotherapist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path with zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed that same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well worn, despite it really being circuitous. Not a single person started a new, more direct route. Subsequent days, and he was a mischievous guy, no matter how many turns and twists, each person in turn followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences or simply by repetition until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous routes. What we do tends to hardwire so that the brain makes it efficient. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey that's different. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism. This is located very close to the emotional center that when we try something new says, this isn't normal. Now, we're going to return to how to use this mechanism is part of a powerful internal navigation system. So, listen to the power of story. Your brain can rewire. New experiences practiced consistently form new neuronal pathways and new neuronal networks. And some remarkable new research shows both beliefs as well as repeating new experiences can both alter gene expression. So when we write a new story and change our minds, we begin to change our brains. Metaphors and narratives even become brain structures. Also from the Black Swan, ideas come and go, stories stay. So here's an experiment. Here's a study, a large study that I believe describes active choice. I'm going to describe a study. Some of you have heard me say this before. And ask you to guess the biggest change impact for this group of volunteers. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to do something different than their usual habit. Each day, the subjects would choose a different option from polls of contrasting behavior, lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive. They would pick one, and they behaved according to what they chose all day long. So an introverted person, for example, would act like an extrovert for an entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they stretched to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. They would eat something they've never eaten before and read something they would never have read before. So, after the end of 4 months, for this large group of volunteers, what do you think was the biggest change in the group? Jot down your best guess. The remarkable finding was that after 4 months, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost everyone had kept the weight off. Many continued to lose weight. The researchers were baffled initially. This wasn't a diet. It was a study focusing on change and its impact. Here's what they found. Asking people to change routine behavior made them actually think about the decisions they made rather than just habitually choosing a default mode without consideration. They began to think about what they ate and began to wonder, is this best for me? Many came to this choice architecture moment. They considered every bite and asked the question, is this bite in my best interest? So they became aware of making choices for everything they did during the day. Once becoming actively aware of making choices, you can decide what's in your best interest, what furthers your story, and what doesn't. As coaches, we are choice architects. We help a client be aware of a choice right now and for the moment in a story that he or she is writing, that it's not there until it's created, and then began to systematically plan what the next steps are for one that will work and achieve their goal. So here are some principles of facilitating change. This is preface to writing a new wellness story. One, each person's life story is created. And don't worry, this is my conclusion here, so we'll talk in just a moment. In adulthood, you create whatever you think, feel, and experience each moment. Every day is a blank page until you begin writing on it, even though it may seem to the individual to just be the way things are. Two, knowing what not to do is at least as important as knowing what to do. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. I got that from back in the day when I practiced psychiatry and psychoanalysis. One of the old codger wise counselors on my alcohol treatment unit would say that to his patients and gave me permission to use it, which I have continued to use and passing it on to you guys now. You may not always know what the next right thing is, but you can almost always know what it isn't. Three, When people create their own answers, they've signed on to invest in the outcome. This is the principle of why we ask someone what they'd like to focus on, where they'd like to get to. People will commit to what they help create. This is the antithesis of giving information. This establishes the beginning of a sense of ownership and effectiveness leading to mastery. And, of course, the antithesis, somebody tells you what to do. They give you information. Nobody's going to pay you for information. They've already paid for Google or access to it. And when someone has a moment of insight, an aha moment, three different parts of their brain light up. When they're given information, a fact, a directive, an order, no part of their brain lights up. Four, change is consistent and inevitable. It's the resistance to change that creates most problems. Five, think about that. Five, small changes lead to big changes. Issues that may seem overwhelmingly large and insurmountable can be approached by looking at the simplicity of the issue in order to specify progress. For example, when you feel overwhelmed by the amount of tasks, pick one. Clarify one issue that, if done today, would be progress. Have your client know when they hang up the phone or log off from talking with you, what are they going to do then? What's their next step? To shrink the change is the beginning of a system to know stepwise. When you have a system, to say it in a different way, when you have a system, you're creating a map. A map tells you where you are, where you're going. You can measure progress along the way, and you can tell what's detour and what's distraction. Those of you who have trained at CTA know the simple coaching model is creating a map. What do you want us to focus on? Where would you like to get to? Then the rest is jazz. You fill in the middle with a co-creation. And this focus on a specific action and way of proceeding exercises effectiveness and initiates a model of mastery. That's the most important thing your client is going to take away, a model of how to do what's next, a model of how to approach things, because the other 23 hours and 7 days, they're not going to have you on the other line, on the other end of the phone or on the computer to ask them the right questions. So you want to help them create their own system. 6, problems, causes, and solutions are not always related or even interconnected. This is another way to say that correlation is not the same as causality. To resolve a problem, even emotionally, to come to the end of a past, does not create a blueprint for success. That I also recognized even more so in making a transition from psychiatry psychoanalysis after 25 years to mentor coaching. That's why there are a lot of frustrated therapy refugees. Strategic plans for specific goals are necessary. If something's a totally new experience, you may need a guide, even for something like a healthier diet or exercise, as well as a mentor coach. 7, the benefit of doing more of what's working and less of what's not will become evident and self-perpetuating. And here's the fundamental bottom line principle of coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't, do something else. 8, you need to know where you're going, goals and strategies. This is a part of having a map. This allows you to focus, to shrink the change to the next step. The end in mind should be in the beginning. If you don't know where you're going, any map will do. Lewis Carroll said it really well. Alice came to a fork in the road. "Which road do I take?" she asked. "Where do you want to go?" asked the Cheshire Cat. "I don't know," Alice answered. Then said the cat, "It doesn't matter." 9, you need the correct paradigm, the correct framework. A paradigm, we can also call that a mindset. It's a model, a theory or frame of reference. It's simply the way we see the world. What we perceive, understand, and interpret is our individual paradigm, analogous to our map. the map explains the territory. It's not the territory itself, but with the right map, planning and strategy can make a huge difference. And we each have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, storylines. We're often not aware of having them, but just assume that we see things the way they are. An example is we need to be afraid of the right thing. Smokers who are afraid of flying. Averaged across all participants, smoking shortens their lives by 5 years. Averaged across all participants, flying shortens their life by 1 day. Or people fear someone entering their homes and committing a violent crime more than food entering their bodies that clog arteries and cause heart attacks. And 10, decide what you want, believe it's possible. A belief is a filter between reality and our perception. A belief is a mind's command to the brain, the software that drives behavior. And as I mentioned, we now know that beliefs can turn genes on or turn them off. You can change your life by changing your beliefs. Our possibilities are determined by the ones that we allow ourselves to see. Remember the two anthropologists. So here's an equation I want to end with. We'll come back to this. And it's three words with an arrow between the first and second word and the second and third word. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. So if your client or you initially in looking at this have performance that you don't like or that's not optimum or peak or simply that you want to examine the behavior that led to that, the antecedents, to see what you may want to tweak or correct. If the behavior is not what you want it to be, look then at the beliefs. And this is hard. This is where we earn our money because so much of our operating system is not conscious. 90 to 95% not being conscious. But there are always clues. There are algorithms. And that's what we're going to begin to talk about next time. Because, you know, in another way of saying it simply, and also why we earn our money, blind spots are by definition ones that someone can't see. Unconscious operating system, by definition, someone's not conscious. Now, here's a caveat. Remember that while we're talking about this in terms of stories or of belief systems, the level of what we're talking about now, the conceptualization, our clients don't see what they're doing as their story. It's not a story. It's just the way things are. Their belief system is not a belief system. It's just the way things are. The anthropologists, they didn't have a belief system that they saw. That was just the way things are, and they lived it out, and it proved them right. We believe what we see. Okay, we're in conversation mode. I'll ask you to manage the background noise. Thoughts or questions that you'd like to ask or comment on, and we'll have a brief discussion. Clarifications first. Is this making sense to you?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Any clarifications or things you'd like a little bit more elaboration on or questions that you have from anything that I've mentioned? Again, this
Coach,
is...
Coach, this is Sandy Bodoni. I have muted myself and didn't talk before.
Okay.
With the health and wellness, how do we invite our clients to change that mindset?
Well, that's a good question and a complex question, and it really evokes the whole nature of what we do in coaching. We began to ask them each session what they want to focus on and where they want to get to, but we have an idea from the beginning. If you have a client information packet and you've asked them to fill out just a 2 or 3 page thing to look at what they want to get out of coaching, where they want to get to, what their major challenges are, what the issues are that they deal with, what they want from you as a coach, you have a beginning awareness – And you can then begin in the first session. What would you like us to focus on first? And remember that you're establishing a model to look at the specific issue to address in that coaching conversation and a destination mm-hmm. of where you get to. So you've shrunk the change to look at one aspect of that, and you've done some work for a client then to have a plan, a systematic approach to that specific issue, a commitment to do it, and then you check the next time to see if they followed through on the commitment. If they didn't, then why start all over with another? That's where you want to start. They made a plan and didn't stick to it. And that's all a client needs. Okay, I need a mute of background noise, please. I can go back on lecture mode, but I'd like to keep it open if you'll manage the background noise. Mute star 6, please. Or either translate that question into...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to go back on lecture mode. So when you do this, you establish a model of a specific focus that you and the client together collaboratively pursue that shrinks the change to a first step of what you do. And that model then is something they can use. You get from them a commitment. You check with them the next time you meet about the commitment. And what I was about to say is you don't need motivation to do something. Motivation is highly overrated. How many times in your CTA classes of Coach to Coach, for example, have you heard somebody begin with, well, I just need to get motivated to lose weight, or I need to get motivated to save money, I need to get motivated to eat a healthier diet. You don't need motivation. All you need is a plan to stick to it. So that's the first question. Do you have a plan? That's the system to know exactly what to do and what to do next. If someone has a plan and doesn't follow through on it, then that's your coaching moment to look at how they decided not to do it. For example, what was your internal conversation the instant that you decided not to follow through? If that conversation was, I decided to start next Tuesday. That internal bargaining created the illusion of doing something, but it's still a way not to follow through. Or someone opposed their own authority and said, "Hell with it, I'm gonna just enjoy this and go out jogging." Or if they get scattered and confused. Or from a different level, if they make a commitment and have a goal and then don't pursue it, it may not be the best consideration to look at sabotaging that goal, because let's say the surface story is 5 to 10%, what we know consciously. The shadow story may go in the opposite direction. For example, someone may have a surface story of, I'd like to generate wealth and a way to create more income. That's a great surface story. But the shadow story that may or may not be conscious goes in the other direction of, I don't think I really have what it takes, or what if I do all that work and still don't get what I want, and then I'd be really embarrassed, or, having more money is just non-spiritual, or substitute a wellness goal and look at what may be a shadow story that goes in the opposite direction that can create stuckness. I'm going to try it again if our buddy has gone on a walk. Okay, does that make sense? And is there another quick question? I know we're a minute over, and I want to respect that. But does that make sense to your question in a beginning way? Because
yes.
The entire
yes.
remainder is going to be addressing that question. What do you say after you say hello? So I would suggest, as you prepare, for example, for the next seminar, to mm-hmm. look at the exercises and work tools in the corresponding component of the workbook, the first three steps of the roadmap. That's what we're going to talk about next time. When you do those yourself, the exercises and work tools, you're going to be in a better position to really process what we're talking about, because you've been there and you've seen what the challenges are, and you see what works and doesn't, and you'll have some informed questions. So, and thanks to those of you who have sent in responses to the question. I welcome other responses from others of you, and I will keep those in mind and incorporate responses to those questions in the discussion as we move ahead. So thanks very much. It's a privilege to work with each of you. I look forward to continuing this collaboration next time. So
thank
we'll
you,
pick
David.
Up right here
okay.
next time. Absolutely. Thank you, guys. See
Take
you
care.
Now.
Will you put a post
thank
of
you
the replay
that.
On there?
I mentioned in the beginning the recording will be posted tomorrow at that site.
Okay,
yes.
Perfect.
Thanks very
All
much.
Right. Thank
you
so
you
much.
Now.
Bye-bye.
Awesome. Thank you, Lord. I made it. Woo. Let's try it again.